Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
All right. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day. Yeah, happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. We don't have any Mother's Day questions today, particularly because I figured the mothers would be busy with other things. But, Greg, why don't you tell us what topics we have on tap?
Okay, we have a great set of questions on waivers to rights-violating laws, the validity of intuition, overcoming past failures, and more.
Yeah, I just realized I had my audio set up completely wrong. Folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Okay, what's been going on this week?
So I recovered from last Sunday's trip to the ER. My appendix seems to be happy again. I got the A-OK from the surgeon. And with the ovary, which is actually what I think caused all the pain, we just get to wait and see and basically see whether the pain recurs, which I'm super excited about, as you can imagine. Anyway, I'm feeling totally fine, and obviously a big, big shout-out to Paul for helping me through all that. He was really fabulous and amazing, and I really appreciated that. So that was all good. So, you know, sort of that was early in my week, but otherwise since then, particularly I've been...
That's pretty exciting, yeah.
Yeah. I've been back to work. I've been particularly preparing my AtlasCon lecture. And for those of you who are, you know, I don't know, interested in new work for me, this really is me grappling with big new ideas. It feels on the order of the Moral Amplifiers lecture I gave a few years ago. Super excited about that. I hope you are too. And so if you haven't registered for AtlasCon, if you're thinking you might want to go, by all means, register and please sign up for my class. It's actually, AtlasCon is over Memorial Day weekend in Atlanta, so it's like 2 weeks from now, and you can still register. And it's really a great time overall, and I definitely encourage folks with an interest in Ayn Rand's philosophy to come and join the party and have a great time. And you can do that over at www.atlos.org.
Excellent.
I think that's it. I'm just like, honestly, though, I have to say, so we got like 5 inches of snow last night, and I had to drive through it at 10:30 to 11:30. 11, like, yeah. Anyway, it was a long drive home.
It's May.
And it's a lot of snow. Anyway, I'm just like, I'm super glad to be here because all I could think of on the drive home was like, I cannot get in a car accident, end up in the hospital, and then have to cancel the show again this week. So, yeah, very glad to be here, home safe. And actually broadcasting. So hopefully nothing will go wrong. Nothing will go wrong.
All good now. It's under control. Okay.
We'll see.
Moving on. Waivers to rights violating laws. Are waivers to rights violating laws good or bad? There are many examples of immoral laws in which the government initiates force against individuals. There are also many examples of groups of people being carved out of the application of such laws via waivers. Some waivers are based on rational motivation, such as business exemptions from Obamacare based on economic burdens. Some waivers are based on irrational motivation, such as religious exemptions from anti-discrimination laws or requirements to provide insurance for birth control because compliance would conflict with a religious conscience. If we begin by agreeing that all initiation of force is immoral, how can we proceed with analyzing whether waivers to immoral laws are good or bad? Are the exceptions good if they're based on rational reasons and bad if based on irrational reasons? Or should we think of the exceptions as either universally good or bad? Philosophically, I'm confused. On one hand, how can I not support all waivers when, in fact, they would result in less initiation of force? On the other hand, I can think of a philosophical argument against all waivers on the following basis. Unequal standards for the application of political force implies a variance in the ethical standards, which implies a variance in the metaphysical nature of man. If we accept the implication that there are essential differences in our nature as human beings, then we have given up the objective basis for rights and opened the door to widespread destruction of freedom. Is that right? How should a person who wants to consistently support individual rights think about this issue of waivers in principle?
Yeah, so this is actually a really good question. I love how thought out this question is. Greg, you notice the same thing too, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm very impressed with how thorough this is.
Yeah. And by the way, I will mention also, this is from a regular contributor, and that's part of the reason why I answered it so soon. So folks who are regular contributors, remember you can make requests of me, and if you want to question me to answer a question, you can basically bribe me to do that with a tip. So just wanted to remind folks of that. Okay, so this came up, I think, in part as a consequence of our recent discussion of taxpayer-funded abortion. Now, as we mentioned there, this is a difficult kind of question. And it's a difficult kind of question because what we really ought to be doing is repealing all these terrible laws so that we stop violating everybody's rights. But that's just not in the realm of politically possible right now. It's given the state of American politics, we just can't reasonably expect that politicians are going to repeal these. And so then what happens is we have to ask, well, what should we do instead? What can we do to sort of minimize the damage or create a better political culture in the future, given that we can't just repeal the law now? And essentially that means that we're asking, given that we will be violating rights here, what's the least terrible way of doing that? And that's a really awful question.
There's not going to be good answers.
Yeah, there's no...
There are no good answers there.
Yeah, there's no right answer there, right? There's maybe better and worse answers, but there's no good answer. There's no right answer. And the reason why there's no right answer is there's painful and oftentimes destructive drawbacks to every possible course that you pick. And so let's just grant as many waivers as possible, right? Let's minimize the rights violations. Well, you do that and you're actually in serious danger of undermining the cause of liberty in future. You're in danger of undermining really fundamental political principles, as we'll see, that, wow, you're, you know, like, okay, great, less rights violations now, but way more rights violations later. So that doesn't seem like a great option. But on the other hand, if you're like, okay, none of that, we're going to deny all waivers, we're going to uphold these political principles, you're in real danger of ruining people's lives by violating their rights in horrible ways, right? And so it seems like you're in this situation where it's, well, you know, flip a coin, right? Head statism wins and tailed individuals lose. This is not a good option. And I do think that the answer is not, as I think I've indicated here already in a way, is not to say, you know, yay waivers or no waivers. There's going to have to be not a middle path, but a sort of subtle way through this. We have to think about this in a little bit more detail and think about, well, do we want to be granting these kinds of waivers? And what are the general principles here? What are some of the considerations? Even if it's not that I'm going to end up with an answer that you're really going to like in the end. There could be legitimate and serious disagreements among people who have the same basic principles here as well. I think that's important.
Yeah, I was going to say that we should be finding that there's a lot of those other scenarios where there's a lot of room for disagreement here because there's no perfect answer here. It's what's the least damaging given what we can figure out.
Exactly. Now, I do think the questioner here has identified the critical danger with waivers. And that is the kind of rationale for the waiver, the principle that the waiver is based upon, the criteria for the waiver might be so corrupt that a policy of having the waiver threatens to worsen the political climate, thereby promoting more and worse rights violations in the future, even if some people are more free in the short term. And I think that's a really serious danger. We don't just want to care about the immediate moment in terms of rights violations. We do need to care about the future. But I don't think in order to see that, we don't need to go quite so abstract as the questioner has done and talk about the metaphysical nature of man. It's not that I think what he said there is particularly wrong. I just think we can appeal to actually more familiar principles here.
Yeah, I think they're just those who would go in that direction are not really undercutting metaphysical nature of man in that way. They're just not being principled.
I think that there is a way in which they're doing it. But I think the more familiar principle here is equality before the law, right? That's actually what the question gets at. By the way, Greg, I'm getting the echo again, so just FYI. We need to figure out how to fix that in a more permanent way.
Fire Skype.
Yeah, if only we could do that. Okay, so what are these more familiar political principles that we need to consider? Well, they are these bedrock principles like equality before the law, rule of law, and separation of church and state. And I know that there's others that would be in play here, but these seem to be the equality before the law. Let's try this sentence again. Equality before the law and rule of law are the two biggies, I think, that are always involved here, and particularly given the political debates that have happened recently and the kinds of waivers that are being granted. Separation of church and state is really relevant here as well. And these principles, I think it's worth noting, these principles are more basic, they are more fundamental than the principle of individual rights. And by that, I mean you can have cultures with stable, settled, reasonably good political systems that have equality before the law and rule of law and separation of church and state, even if they don't have a clear understanding of or if they're misguided on individual rights. And certainly a lot of basically pre-American Revolution cultures were of that sort. Not a lot of them. There were a few of them like that. And you can see that, wow, it's even if we don't have a concept of individual rights, like in ancient Greece, they didn't have a concept of individual rights, to have the concept of equality before the law and rule of law is really, really important. And that actually
it can lead to good outcomes, even if they don't have that clear understanding, can lead to a lot of good outcomes.
Right.
And
you actually
stop a lot of dysfunction.
You actually get more protection of individual rights there, even if there's not that explicit concept. So these are hugely, hugely important principles. I really want to emphasize this. And these are definitely threatened by certain kinds of waivers for bad laws. And the case I want to start with, I want to look at two particular cases. The religious conscience exceptions for birth control coverage and concealed carry laws. So let's take the religious conscience exemptions for birth control first. Now, obviously, birth control coverage should not be mandated by law. But the waiver doesn't address that. It doesn't address the fundamental rights violation of the government telling insurance companies, here's the things that you have to cover. Right? What it's doing instead, what it's saying is, oh, no, we can't have people's religious views being violated. In other words, it treats a specific class of views about a specific set of things as privileged and sacrosanct. And so people get a free pass so long as their moral principles are not based on facts or rational reasons, but instead based on faith, meaning on emotion and authority, and thus on matters pertaining to so long as their views pertain to sex. Right? And that is a violation of the separation of church and state. It's a violation of equality before the law because people who say, look, I want to base my moral principles on facts and rational reasons, and that's why I don't want mandated coverage for any of these things. I want to have this be a private matter between my insurance company and me. Well, their views just don't count in the slightest, right? But if you say, Jesus told me, then suddenly you get to a waiver for the law. And I think that's a real fundamental problem here. That's a violation of the separation of church and state. Okay, so let's take the case of concealed carry laws because I think there's some interesting issues in here. So you can imagine there's four basic types of concealed carry laws. There's no issue, meaning nobody gets a concealed carry permit. You have may issue, meaning that the sheriff can issue or not at his discretion. And then you have shall issue, meaning that the state says, here, look, you sheriff, you have to issue a concealed carry permit, provided that the person, you know, completes training and does a background check and that kind of thing. And then you also have constitutional carry, which just says, look, if you're not a felon and you're not, you know, mentally ill or whatnot, then you have a right to carry without getting the government's permission. I'm going to lump shall issue with constitutional carry in this because it doesn't matter so much. Now, obviously, no issue. This violates everyone's rights and it violates them equally. And so, you know, I can say, look, definitively, like states should be shall issue or constitutional carry. And this is, you know, no issue, like there's no waivers in that. May issue is basically a kind of waiver-based system, right? And it really depends on how that gets implemented, whether that's a good thing or not. It can be really good for individual people and even for the cause of liberty if you have a sheriff who treats it like shall issue. And this was actually the position that we were in when we moved to Colorado. It was what our sheriff did in our county, which is part of why we ended up in Douglas County, was because the sheriff, Colorado at the time, you know, the Columbine shooting had happened, and so the shall issue law got scuttled after that. And so Colorado basically had may issue. And some counties were like, absolutely not. They treated it like no issue. Some counties had, you know, surely political favoritism and all that. But Douglas County basically had a system, and they said, look, you have to complete this training, and you have to have this background check, and then we will issue you. And that was actually, like, it was good for the individuals in the county because they got to have their concealed carry permits. And it was also good for the cause of liberty in the sense that it set a precedent. And so other counties in the state who were – and people in the state who were thinking about these kinds of things could look at the example of Douglas County and say – well, look, they don't have high crime rates. They don't have people being gunned down in the streets, and yet they basically have a shall issue system.
Yeah. So it sounds like depending on how they're doing it, they could be either supporting rule of law or undercutting it.
Right. But it depends on the quality of the sheriff, which is in a way, even though there's this like veneer of rule of law, underneath of that is this rule of man problem.
Yep.
Right? Now,
it's just potentially degrading one thing rather than degrading one thing and elevating another separate bad thing.
Yeah. So I mean,
that's a difference with the religious one.
Right. Other counties, I think the worst case is when it is really treated as this waiver type system where you basically, the sheriff gets to give concealed carry permits to politically connected people and to, you know, big businessmen and to his friends and that kind of thing. And that certainly happens in lots and lots of places. And that, I think, is the worst possible outcome. Because on the one hand, individuals who really do need this, let's say women who have been abused by their husbands and need to protect themselves in the process of getting divorced, people who are, you know, going into dangerous neighborhoods, people who are, you know, just have other kinds of risks that they want to be able to protect themselves. They can't do that. They're not going to get a concealed carry permit. So those people's rights are being violated, and the potential harms to them are really obviously serious. And on the other hand, there's no political pressure to get a shall issue because the politically connected people, hey, they can get what they want anyway. And instead, what you have is this idea: well, it's totally okay for this completely to be at the discretion of the sheriff. And that's basically enshrining the principle of rule of man rather than rule of law. And so that's sort of the worst possible outcome. But you can see that waiver-based system, how it can, particularly it can be used for really, really bad ends, and particularly whether it gets used for that or not depends on the quality of people in office, which is not what we want, right? This is exactly why rule of law is so important, is so that there is – You're not dependent on the whims and the, you know, well, how actually good is my sheriff? You want rule of law so that the sheriff himself is bound by good law. So I think there's considerations here about how this works, how this plays out. But you can see that there's real dangers of waivers undermining these fundamental principles. Now, what I think is interesting, and I would like to think about this a little bit more. But what I think is interesting is that I don't see the same problems with waivers based on economic hardship, right? Because one of the things that's happening here is if those waivers are done well, they're oftentimes an attempt to preserve equality before the law, in that they're an attempt to lessen the disproportionate impact of regulations on individuals and small businesses. There's economies of scale, and those kinds of things matter. And for a business, let's say if you have a, let's say you're a farmer and you have 500 chickens, right? And you're raising organic chickens and you're doing all this kind of stuff. If you have to comply with the regulations that are designed for chicken producers who are producing 100,000 chickens a year, that's going to put you out of business in very, very short order. And the regulations in a way don't make sense as applied to you. And so if you get a waiver because, well, you're small, or you're organic or whatever it is, that kind of issue, that's actually a way of enabling greater equality before the law. It sounds somewhat paradoxical, but it's definitely an issue. And I've run into this in campaign finance regulations, where it's one thing to say, oh, yeah, you're an organization spending millions of dollars, you have to report. Well, look, you can hire attorneys and accountants on you. In fact, I already have those on staff. I'm a person who has to do all this myself, and that imposes – and try to even understand the law, and that imposes a disproportionate burden on me than it would on you, you know, in terms of the amount of time that I have to spend relative to what my output is or what my income is. So there's some really difficult and tricky issues here, but I think that the thing to look out for is, is this waiver system undermining fundamental principles? Is it undermining rule of law? Is it undermining equality before the law? Is it undermining separation of church and state?
Indeed. Okay, what about the practical effects of widespread waivers?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that's relevant here is to think, am I basically eliminating allies, right? So imagine you have widespread religious exemptions to bad laws, which is pretty much what Republicans want right now. Well, you've eliminated the majority of your potential allies, because basically what you've said is, well, only the atheists are going to be burdened here. Only people who have odd religious views, you know, views that are outside the mainstream, those are only the people that are going to be burdened. And religious people, basically, they're never going to be concerned once they get the exemption that they want. And so I think there's a real sort of practical political danger with that. And it's not that you want everybody's rights to be violated so that they'll be your allies, but, like, make sure that you're not leaving people, you're not sort of damaging your hopes for political change in the future. And certainly, again, there's an equality before the law issue here. And we can also imagine, let's say, tax waivers for certain groups based on their religion or their race or their profession or so on. This would make for much more political divisiveness. It would make for worse racism. It would make for this class warfare. And again, that's not overall good for the state of America.
Yeah, you're balkanizing the population.
Yeah. And we already have enough of that. Thank you very much. And I will say also, there is a big difference here between carving out exemptions through waivers and giving everybody partial freedom. Like, one of the things that partial freedom does and is enable people to see, oh, wow, like, we haven't all died. This isn't a political disaster. Maybe we can go a little bit further. Maybe here we've had medical marijuana. Maybe we can just legalize marijuana. The exemptions oftentimes, they don't show that. It's not clear what's going on. It's not clear that protecting individual rights here is actually better, that we should move in the direction of freedom. And in fact, particularly things like religious exemptions make people want to have more anti-discrimination laws or firmer anti-discrimination laws because, gosh, this seems really unfair. And you actually then hear stories about people, you know, they're trying to get their birth control, or they were raped and they're trying to get Plan B and they can't get it in the middle of the night. And those kinds of stories make it seem like what we need is more regulations and more controls, not, hey, look, partial freedom for everybody. And those kinds of practical considerations, they aren't primary, but I do think they matter here in thinking about what we wanted, what's our best strategy politically.
Okay. Let's boil it down. What's the take-home point?
So I think the value of waivers primarily depends on the underlying rationale for them, particularly whether they promote or undermine basic political principles like rule of law, equality before the law, and the separation of church and state.
All right. A little bit of follow-up here. KPOM asks, should the answer be whatever will drive political demand for repeal? Stated otherwise, if forcing Catholic hospitals to provide taxpayer-funded abortions would help them get behind a repeal, would that be the better course of action?
No, I don't think that's the only consideration here, and I don't think that's primary, right? Again, as I just said, Greg, I'm getting the echo. So that's not the primary concern, and particularly the Catholic hospitals are going to continue to argue for a waiver because that is what they want. They want their religious exemption. So it's I don't know that that's going to be particularly helpful. I think you can use those examples as to say, hey, look, maybe we shouldn't be forcing hospitals to provide services that they don't want to. But I don't like using the religious case as a big example is actually not particularly helpful, I don't think, precisely because the common response to that is, well, let's just carve out an exception for them.
The equality before the law is very important. We can't do that. And using that to drive them towards the principle of like, oh, well, if we can't have an exemption for our particular way, maybe we shouldn't be forcing anybody to do this at all. Would that be enough to get them to say, yeah, no more forcing any business for any reason?
I mean, you can't. There is no argument that you will give that you can say that will force people to see X, Y, Z, right?
No, you can't force it. Sorry, we'll drive them towards seeing.
You can. It can encourage them. I mean, you can make the arguments, right? But it's not particularly the people who are the hardcore like Catholic activists. Like, I've seen too many of their email alerts to think that they're they're on our side in any way, shape, or form. And it would take a real fundamental revolution in their thinking to bring them on to a side that I would be comfortable with.
To actually have lead them to think, oh, well, if freedom of conscience is good for me, maybe it's good for others too.
Yes.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. No, religious, I mean, religious people like to treat their religious views in politics as like special snowflakes. I mean, they just think like, you know, my religious belief here, this is untouchable. This is, you know, it's my own little special snowflake. And it's particularly special if lots of people share it. And
I guess I have noticed that in the, hey, theocracy is bad, right? And they're like, oh, yeah, theocracy is terrible, except for my theocracy.
Yeah.
Because it's true. Yeah. The one true theocracy, I guess.
Right.
All right. Depressing. So it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just a live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide, and we do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. So again, you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support. Greg, I think you're on mute.
Well, that'll slow things down. Did you even hear a conga?
Yes, I heard a conga.
Oh, interesting. Okay, the validity of intuition. Does intuition have any validity? Intuition is defined as the ability to understand something immediately without the need for conscious reasoning. Assuming that we're not talking about mystical insight, is this possible? When, if ever, should a person rely on such intuitions? How should he check them?
Yeah, so this is a good question, and Greg, you and I, we had a really good discussion about this, I thought. I really enjoyed that. And what I thought was interesting about it is that both you and I, we do rely on intuition heavily in this non-mystical sense. So we're going to talk about what that actually means here.
Yeah.
And what I want to do is I want to contrast, I think just to make this clear, contrast what I'll call intuitive thinking with deliberative thinking. And this is sometimes called fast thinking versus slow thinking, but I like intuitive versus deliberative better. So intuitive thinking means that you are making very quick judgments, you're relying heavily on your background knowledge and sometimes even your emotions. The right answers just seem obvious to you, and they're oftentimes difficult to explain. But it's not mystical, even though it really can feel sometimes like Jesus is whispering the correct answer to you.
Right? God implanted it in my mind.
Yes, and if I were religious, no. I might be inclined to think that.
It's a revelation, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's just using automation. Automation.
If you're going to make those intuitive leaps and if they're going to be any good, basically you have to have lots of experience, lots of expertise in the field, lots of facts, and you need to give your subconscious the order to say, hey, solve this problem for me and then go do other things. And sometimes, boom, the right answer will pop up.
Yeah. It's a little like doing a Google search. You know the sorts of terms you need to use. You're hoping you'll see the right kind of thing float up in the results. And once you see the results, you can go and investigate. Oh,
right.
Yeah, that is what I wanted.
Right. And so we can see this, let's say an ER doc, Paul gave us this example. An ER doc might say, like, wow, that, like, they might see a patient walk into the ER and just say, wow, that patient just has the look of the undiagnosed cancer patient. And it's not that there's, and that would be a kind of intuition. And it's not some kind of mystical insight or psychic connection or anything. No, there's just a lot of subtle little clues that this doctor has seen time and time and time again. And that adds up to this certain impression, this certain look of it.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Greg.
Oh, sorry. This should sound familiar to everyone. It's the same process of integration that's happening all the time with all the things we automatize, like learning to swing a tennis racket or a golf club well, learning, training your emotions. It's all the same thing. Things you do consciously and slowly and difficultly end up being automatized. And the trick is knowing when you've automatized the right things versus not.
Right.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, and I find the same thing, particularly for me, having dealt all my life with horses, that their behavior is very apparent to me. Like what they mean by how they're acting Like, they're interpreting their body language as second nature for me. And so I read things in The Horse, and it's obvious to me. And the people who aren't familiar with horses will have no idea. And they'll be like, well, how can you tell the horse is X? And I'm like, how can you not see it? It's just, plain as day. But then I have to go through and say, no, like, here's what they're doing with their hindquarters, and here's how their eye looks, and here's how their ears look, and you know, this kind of thing, and this, and this, and this. And that can be, if you're not used to giving those explanations, it can be really difficult to unearth that and say, yeah, here's why I think what I think here.
Yeah, it's similar to the introspective process of sort of monitoring your emotions. It's like, is this a well-founded emotion? Is it really connected to the facts? And that's that background process that we always talk about. Here, you're being asked, what's the source of this kind of your intuition? And you go off and you sift through, what are the cues that I'm picking up on here?
Right. Okay, so that kind of intuitive thinking is contrasted with deliberative thinking. And by that, I just mean that you're consciously slowly working through a process of reasoning, going from step A to B to C. And your answers, they're developed by this careful consideration of all the relevant facts. You know, you're thinking about everything very explicitly. You're being very thorough. You're being very careful. So you can imagine the same ER doc in another case, he might not get that intuition. And so what he does in that case is he's got a bunch of labs, and he's got a bunch of tests, and he's got the history, and he's got his exam. And he looks at all that, and he would deduce, look, there's got to be some undiagnosed cancer here. And that would be this process of deliberative thinking. And we all also, you know, we do that all the time as well, certainly.
So he would go off and do what is it called, differential diagnosis, where he's looking at the various possibilities and eliminating some and lifting others until he's finally sorted it down to, yeah, there's good evidence for this.
Right. And that's pretty much, we did a lot of that last Sunday in terms of, you know, like, what's going on with the appendix? Like, how was that the cause of the pain that I experienced? It seems unlikely. And so what would that be? And blah, blah, blah. Like, there was a lot of that kind of deliberative thinking. There was very little intuitive thinking in the ER last Sunday. And I will say, everybody does both kinds of thinking. I think really you couldn't get along in life just by doing intuitive thinking. You'd end up dead, actually, in pretty short order. And if you were just doing deliberative thinking, you would know nothing. I mean, you would be so slow at life, you would have been run over by a bus already.
You would also be dead, yes.
Yes. But I do think that although everybody does both, people do tend to lean towards one or the other as their default, as their most comfortable mode of reasoning. And so for me, I definitely lean towards intuitive kind of thinking. I'm not a slow and methodical person. I prefer to, you know, gather lots and lots of data to mull it over. But that experience of that, like, boom, when that right answer just pops out. This is what you should do, Diana. And it's oftentimes something I've never heard of. It's exciting. I feel like I have the power of the gods when this happens. Right? So, like, that's super awesome. I really like that. And whereas methodical thinking, it's all that's work and that's hard. And I, you know, okay, I'll do it. But it's not fun. It's not exciting in the way that you
love the flash of insight. But the next person down might love laying out the careful argument that has everything just lined up in the spreadsheet.
That's
and
ridiculous.
Very satisfying.
I suppose that somebody could be like that. I suppose.
Yeah. Or you could be, I think in my case, I rely on both pretty darn heavily just because of the kind of work I do. And so I don't know if I lean hard one way or the other. I'd have to watch myself.
But you do, like you, we were talking about this, you have this in your programming work, you do rely on this sort of intuitive sense of how things are going.
Oh, absolutely. But then I also have to do the methodical thing too, because that's writing code.
Right.
and it's satisfying too. It's just that it's two steps for me. First step, I have to use intuition to bring together all the different principles of engineering and factors in the solution that are important to see the direction to go. And then I have to actually validate it and build a code. So it's really hard. I can't do one without the other.
Right.
All right. So, that was the thing I was going to talk about. When I'm doing that intuitive work, the language I use for that is that there's a certain hum to a solution. Like it's hitting on enough cylinders that it feels right. And the way I can tell is because I know that I know enough about the domain to know that the right things are being hit hard enough. And so I can say, okay, this is becoming a satisfying solution. And if I'm in a domain where I don't know enough about it to know that the right proportion or hardness of things are being hit in the right way, I just won't get that hum, which is completely vague, intuitive kind of talk for, you know, I've lined up. I can tell that I've lined up the right things. And it actually, that hum happens in philosophical things too here. We're talking about this or that, and I know the fundamental principles of, you know, that are relevant for, say, the area. And then we're looking at concrete, and my subconscious is telling me, do we know enough about this area? Have we hit enough of different kinds of cases? Is the hum there? And I probably even have used that kind of language in some of our discussions. I was like, no, this doesn't have the right hum to it. This there's something missing. Versus, no, I'm satisfied. This is very satisfying.
Yeah, like we're getting it. Like we're making progress. We're seeing new integrations. We've got our examples are all lining up. We're getting to new principles. You know, everything is lining up in the right ways, and you can sort of see that intellectually.
You can see that it explains the cases at hand, and then it feels better when there's someone else like you, different than me, in the discussion. You've come in with different angles than I would have. And, oh, good, it's handling that too. And then as we're talking, we come up with some other random cases. And a lot like a scientist having their theories tested, they pass the tests. And it's like, ooh, this is starting to sound really satisfying, because even cases that I'm surprised by are being covered. It's like, okay, good.
Right.
But that's just one part of it, the testing against odd cases. I know enough about the domain to know the relevant fundamentals, and those are covered, and on and on. So it's a subtle balancing act.
Yeah, and I will say this is why, and this kind of hum of a process, I always think of it like here I'm driving along and it's smooth sailing or it's smooth driving, is for me how the writing process works. And I've always felt like I should have an outline. I should, you know, have this methodical system, because this is what you're taught. And you know, you're taught that you should have everything planned out, and then just the writing should be, you know, you shouldn't be figuring out what you're going to say as you're writing. You should know that from your outline. Whereas I've always had to basically write, and then if I have to, like with papers, I remember in high school there was a paper that I had to write, and I had to turn in an outline along with the paper. Well, I wrote the paper, and then I wrote the outline afterwards, because that's what has to happen. And so, you know, I have a rough outline. I have, you know, a paper with crazy marks all over it and arrows going from here to there and the other thing. And I have a general plan, but then I write, and what happens is, like, the hum, I'll get the hum, I'm going along smoothly, and then things will get rocky and they'll get tough and they'll get difficult, and it's like trying to go through molasses. And I'm like, okay, I've gone wrong somewhere. I've veered off the path in some way. I need to go back, read what I've written, figure out where I veered off the path, and then, you know, go in a different direction from there, go left rather than right. And that has to be my process. And I always felt terribly guilty about this, like I was doing it wrong. And particularly writing my dissertation cured me of that, because, God damn it, I wrote a whole freaking book using that method, and I got it done, and it was good, and it worked. And so screw you, all you people who want me to do outlines. So, but that's because the intuitive thinking is more comfortable for me. And so that is the right writing process for me.
Yeah, and it's cool that you've found the process. So the swimming through molasses thing, that is definitely that's part of when you're validating your intuitions. That's one of the things I look for. It's like that background thread that's monitoring my emotions. If an application of some idea we're talking about, or an architectural feature in something I'm building, if I notice that I'm straining to make it work, I have to be honest and say, oh no, it's kind of like, am I rationalizing this fitting, or was it really a smooth fit?
Right.
And the same thing would happen in writing. Was that explanation easy, or was I really working it and laying out this argument? Is like, no, I'm really straining at this.
Yeah, am I forcing it?
That would cause me to go back and ask myself, am I really accounting for everything here?
Yeah.
All right. So, hey, is one way of doing this more rational than the other?
No,
like,
we need to talk about
the untrue way.
We need to talk about checking intuitions first. I want to say a little bit more.
Okay, more on checking.
Yeah. So obviously we do need to check our intuitions. We know that the subconscious is not infallible. And at least for me, I know that, I mean, in addition to this sense of like, oh, it's not working, I know that sometimes something can seem like the right answer, particularly for things that are not processes, but discrete decisions, right? I can get the answer of like, ta-da, like this is what I need to do. But my subconscious might not have in mind all the important factors, all the relevant factors here. So I always am checking my intuition after I have that burst of insight. And this is true even if I'm just thinking about what I want to eat for dinner. For something as trivial as that, I need to make sure, like, is this on diet? Is this something that's healthy for me? Is this something that will fit in with my fitness and workout goals? Is this something that's appropriate for, you know, for what my goals are at this particular time? So, and so, like, sometimes for dinner, right, that takes 2 seconds to do. But sometimes if it's a big decision, I'm going to give myself weeks to think about that. I'm going to do more research. I'm going to do more deliberation. I'm going to review what my criteria were. I'm going to let that decision sit for a while and make sure it's okay. So what I do with that kind of checking is basically I review the problem and my proposed solution while in a kind of deliberative mode. So I ask myself, does this proposed solution really overcome all the difficulties here? Does it create new problems? What are the implications of this? I need to make sure that I'm not just acting on biases. I need to make sure that I'm not acting on my emotions. And so I'm going to ask myself, what's the rational case for this course? And Greg, as you mentioned here, it's oftentimes really helpful to consult with other people, particularly with people with other values or other ideas, other personalities, because that can raise considerations that I hadn't thought of. And so working through that with other people, that can give me a check on my intuition as well. And basically, I don't think that this is hard. Obviously, if you tend to be a very intuitive thinker, you need to develop your skills of deliberative thinking. But it's not really hard to do this. It's not hard to check your intuitions, so long as you're very clear that these are not actually from Jesus, right? If they're from Jesus, or if you think they're from Jesus, right, checking might actually seem like questioning Jesus, and that could seem irreligious, and that could be a problem. So so long as you don't have bad views about what these intuitions are, so long as you know actually what the intuitions are, that is enough of a check. In a way, that encourages you to go, wait, I've got to make sure this is the right thing.
And importantly, it's if you don't think it's a flash of insight from God or whatever, you know that it's a result of something your subconscious is integrating, some inputs from some sources, some thinking you've done in the past, some experience you had. So that leads you to a kind of development mindset where, and this is truly what goes on in my head, I rely on these intuitions, but I'm always watching them for soundness and errors, especially. If I catch myself having an intuition that's wrong, or that led me down a blind alley and wasted my time, or that's hugely concerning. I want to catch that so that I can start retraining the automation that led me there.
Exactly.
Much like with emotions, I'm paranoid. I'm watching for and alert for any problem, and that only happens if you recognize that this stuff has a basis in reality in the way your brain works. It's not a flash of insight from God.
Right.
All right, so now is one way of doing this more rational than the other?
Yeah, basically is deliberative thinking more rational than intuitive thinking? This is, I think, a critical question, and this was, for me, the most interesting little bit of this question. And the answer is no, right? Being rational doesn't always mean being careful and calculating in some deliberate, process-focused, upfront way where you gradually come to the right conclusion. What it does mean is that your decisions are based on the facts. And so if you are thinking intuitively, you're going to have to make sure that that's based on the facts. You're going to have to feed lots of facts to your subconscious before your intuitive leap, and then you're going to have to check your thinking afterwards. But don't think that deliberative thinking is the gold standard here. Don't think that anything else is, well, you being irrational, you being emotionalistic, that kind of thing. Don't think that you have to write that freaking outline in order to write an essay. You just don't.
the hallmark of being rational is being reality-oriented, fact-oriented. Not being mystical. So keeping that mindset of focusing on reality, focusing on the method I'm using to get there versus relying on insight from God or something, that's really the hallmark that you're after. You want to stay focused on reality. And in this sense, both of these methods are very much focused on reality.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Awful lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
So in the non-mystical sense, intuitive thinking means that you allow your subconscious to solve some problem, and the answer often seems like a bolt from the blue. And then if you do want to be rational, as you should, you're going to need to engage in some deliberative thinking in order to check that answer.
Indeed. No follow-up stuff. We must have given a wonderful case for our intuitively listening listeners who are very satisfied now. All right. Some listeners can't afford to contribute financially. Can they help out in some other way?
Yeah, absolutely. Any of you can help us promote the show by sharing our work on social media. You can share blog posts, upcoming events, and posted podcasts. That helps promote the show to a wider audience, and every share feels like a pat on the back to both of us. So thanks, folks, for doing that.
Overcoming past failures. How can I overcome my past failure to capitalize on the perfect opportunity? 2 years ago, after years of struggling in the post-2008 job market, I had a job opportunity that could have been the best thing that ever happened to me. It was a job that represents my values and could have brought me much-needed financial success if I'd pulled it off. But it was also an extremely difficult, demanding, and stressful proposition, and I was uncertain whether I had what it would take to succeed at it. To make matters worse, when it came along, I was depressed to the point of having lost the will to live. In my bad emotional state, I was unable to go through with the job, and I let the opportunity slip. In the 2 years since then, I have done nothing but hold down a menial job while reflecting on the missed opportunity. I can't move on or get over the fact that what I did and have become almost obsessed with it. I need to approach the employer and ask him for another chance at it. It is doubtful that he would say yes, but I have nothing to lose by trying. However, for all the same reasons I didn't go through with it before, I still cannot work up the will to do it. Every day I wake up wanting to die, and I am so depressed that I can't feel the warmth of a great opportunity. Everything just seems hopeless and pointless. How can I rehabilitate myself enough to approach the employer for a second chance?
So this is a hard question, right? And first and foremost, I would say please, 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 like right now, yesterday, please seek out therapy. You have been suffering from a serious and longstanding depression, and you really need professional help, and you might need meds. Like, this is really, really important. This is in terms of how you rehabilitate yourself, and I'll say more about the job in a minute, but how you rehabilitate yourself, you need to get your life on track first and foremost, and this is a serious problem. This is not a problem that you can philosophically work yourself out of. You need professional psychotherapy. You need help. So that's the first thing and foremost. That's like the alpha and the omega here. But I do want to give you a few thoughts about this job opportunity, two things in particular that I want to say about this. So first of all, it is very, very, very unlikely that this job is everything that you seem to think it is. No job is all that. No job on the planet. And so, yes, you are obsessing on it, and you're not being objective, and that's something that, again, hopefully therapy will help with.
Yeah. But an analogy that might be helpful here is that of people who there's a notion in our culture, people think there's the one true mate out there for me, and if I missed her, she came along and she slipped through my fingers, and now I'll never find love. But that's not really how it works. There are a lot of great mates out there for everybody. And depending on who you come across and when, you'll cultivate that relationship and it'll become the one perfect thing for you. But it could have been any of many other people who would be the one perfect person for you would develop into, develop your relationship with. So the same is true with any of these big decisions. You think about this wonderful job. And, well, okay, that one's passed, but there's another one you could come across and you could cultivate that relationship similarly. The same for houses. Right? The one perfect house that was on the market and somebody else snapped it up and I'll never live in an awesome house like that again. Well, until you do find an awesome house.
Right.
Then this is the one perfect house that's happened. Each of those has happened to me over and over, and it's probably happened to you and you just didn't notice it.
Yeah, and it's – one way to think about these kinds of things like great jobs and loving spouses and houses are things that they're values that you cultivate, right? And so it doesn't make sense to say, oh, this is going to be the one perfect thing. No, and in fact, if you go into a relationship like that or a house like that or a job like that, you're going to be terribly, terribly disappointed. you'll have this honeymoon period where everything seems perfect, but then things will start to go wrong, and you're like, oh, this is horrible. This is not working. And by the way, kids are like this. Pets are like this too. You know, so you have to go in going.
80% of everything is crap. It's like there's the 20% you're focused on, and then there's the rest. It's like every job.
Right, right. So you're going to need to go in there with a mindset of like, this has great potential, and I want to get the best out of this. But there's lots of things that have tons and tons of potential out there of any kind of value. And you know, if you had a spouse other than your own, I mean, there's things that would definitely not work, right? There's things that don't have that potential, but there's a wide range of things that have potential, and it's your life would go in different directions if you had different children or different pets or different spouse or a different job, but that doesn't mean it's a worse direction. So I think you've got to really, really let that go. You've got to let that idea go that you've ruined your life by foregoing this job opportunity. I mean, the only job I can think of where that's really true is if you're an astronaut and you're like, no thanks, I don't really want to go to the moon, right? You know, like then yes, you have given up a crazy amazing opportunity. And what were you thinking? You like, okay, then you've ruined your life, right? But that's not what this is. You're not going to the moon. So you've got to work on letting that go. You've got to work on developing a different mindset about these kinds of values, these kinds of opportunities.
Yeah, it's another example that I think you just had float by. Think about many people, they choose whether or not to have children. I'm one of those. Tammy chose to have a kid. I never chose to have a kid. We each had a wonderful life in that direction. It's I see it happen all the time. That's a huge decision. The same thing with your career, this or that job. You can make yourself into an awesome manager of this or producer of that or whatever. So, the one and only perfect relationship, job, house, car, or anything else is kind of a myth, and you don't want it to rule your thinking, especially if it shuts you down.
It's really a myth. Really a myth, yeah.
Yeah, it's really a myth. You don't want it to shut you down because you should be this growth engine, optimizing everything that you're doing, not
right.
Shutting down.
Right. And Earl actually says in the chat, he says, I would also suspect that there could be other good opportunities around this person in his or her life that he or she is overlooking because they're so fixated on this one past opportunity. Try to look for the next thing. And I would absolutely, absolutely agree with that. If you know, if you're fixated on, you know, like my soulmate and she was the one for me and you know, I'm doomed and it's hopeless because she's, you know, she's married somebody else, you're not going to notice the six other girls that are in your life that would actually be well worth dating and have potential.
I'm going to have to ask a follow-up to Trey because I don't know his reference with Max Headroom is.
Your sound quality is going like it's fairly regular intervals where your sound goes, it starts stuttering. And so that's been our whole thing today. And I would have actually thought about having you hang up and recall, but I think it's Mother's Day, and I think so Skype is overloaded, and so we're in trouble.
Everybody's talking with Mom.
Yeah.
Sorry for the sound quality.
I know. I wish, like, Greg, if only you would move to Colorado, we could solve these problems. Yeah.
But, I want fiber into my building. That might help, too.
Oh, how about, yeah, same here. Yeah, both of us have shitty internet. Sorry for the swear word, but anyway, okay, so that's
yeah.
The first thing.
So the myth of the one true job.
Yes. The second thing is you weren't ready for this job 2 years ago, so you were right to refuse it. And I would say you're not ready for it now either. You cannot possibly take on an extremely difficult, demanding, and stressful proposition, a stressful job, while suffering from severe depression. So you didn't make a mistake in not pursuing the position initially, but what you have made a mistake in here is allowing yourself to wallow in this depression. And hopefully that's probably an unfair characterization. It doesn't sound like you've sought out therapy and that's a problem. So don't dwell on that mistake, right? But just please do not persist in that. You need to fix this. You absolutely need to seek out therapy. And you're going to have to start stretching yourself in small ways. You're going to have to make yourself capable of doing an awesome job, whether this job or something else. And you're going to have to start small on this. You can't just leap into something that's difficult, demanding, and super stressful. That's just not the way to succeed here. You're going to have to develop your resilience. You're going to have to develop your skills of mental coping and ambition and peace of mind and so on. So I think that has to be your first priority here. Just, I mean, it's obvious in the question, you were suffering these 2 years ago, you're suffering now, and you do want better. And that's really, really good. That's hugely important. But I think that you need to focus your energies in a different direction. Instead of focusing on this job, you do need to focus on your mental health. You need to focus on your peace of mind, your resilience, your ambition, your happiness. And if you do that, if you get that sorted out, even just to a small extent, you are going to be capable of so much more than just this one job. Your life is going to improve so much more. It's going to improve across the board.
Yeah, indeed. Just removing the impediment of the depression and beginning that process of building up your strengths.
Yes.
And you had a prior podcast where you talked about exactly that. There's a method to it. You can give yourself these little challenges and build your strengths. And please go back and listen to that podcast.
Yeah, that's on developing resilience. I have that that'll be in the show notes.
So. Excellent.
Yeah.
So. Yes, you can do it. All right. Anything else?
No, I think let's do the take-home point.
Okay, take-home point.
So you sound as if you're suffering from serious clinical depression, and so please, the alpha and the omega here is please seek out therapy. This job, the lost opportunity here, is really not your problem at all. No job is all that, and I do think you need to rethink how you're thinking about these kinds of core values.
Indeed. Any follow-up action? No. Moving on. All right, it's rapid-fire question time. We're going to put Dinah in the hot seat. I'll ask questions from this long and growing queue in any old order I want, and we'll see what happens because, you know, we haven't done a whole bunch of show prep on that. Could get interesting. All right. Hey, what do you think of Benjamin Franklin's 13 virtues? Temperance, silence, order, resolution, frugality, industry, sincerity, justice, moderation, cleanliness, tranquility, chastity, and humility. Those all sound like amplifiers.
Yeah, but not all of them are good.
Most,
I mean, like,
most, yeah.
Silence?
Yeah, I don't know what that is, yeah.
Let somebody who's a high C, high S, right? Also, chastity? Dude, no.
No. I was focusing on the
sexual discretion,
thing.
Yes. I would take that as a virtue, but chastity, no.
I'm down with the justice.
Moderation isn't a justice. Justice is an actual virtue.
Yeah.
Industry is basically productiveness. I'll take that one.
It sounds like this is a grab bag of just things he associated with success or happiness.
Right. I do think if this worked for him, other than the ones that really aren't virtues like chastity, if this worked for him, like all good to identify the things that are really important in your life. And before you have a clear concept of what counts as a virtue versus a moral amplifier, you know, all right, that's all good. You know, I'm not going to fault him too much for not having discovered Ayn Rand's concept of virtue, right? But so I don't think that these are particularly helpful. I don't know that I've read much of any Franklin, and so I haven't read his take on these, and that's what I would be most interested. But there might be genuine value in this kind of thing. At least for some people, I think it would be highly dependent on personality. But there might be real value for people in this. And if so, take it and run with it.
Okay. Next up, a little political here. Ayn Rand adamantly rejected Reagan because of his pro-life stance, stating that he could not defend individual rights. Do you think an objectivist can rationally justify voting for a pro-lifer today?
So this is an interesting question. One of the things that I think is relevant to Ayn Rand's views on this, well, first of all, just because it was Ayn Rand's view doesn't mean anybody has to agree with it. It's a very contextual, personal judgment, and not everybody has to agree, right? So, like, it's the opinion of, I would take her views on this as the opinion of somebody whose judgment I really respect, and I'm interested in hearing her reasons for it. Now, at the time, the pro-life movement was very small. And so Reagan, I think, was unique in the sense that he really courted the evangelicals, and he courted them in part by adopting a pro-life stance, which was apparently not – it was a calculated move on his part. or rather an anti-abortion stance, I should say. And so given the political climate, given the Republicans who came before him, this was new and notable, and it was a shift. And I think that's important in this case. Well, at this point, the shift has long since happened, right? And there's nobody, it's pretty much impossible to be a pro-choice Republican these days, unless you're in a very, very Democratic state in general. My own personal principle in light of that is that I will not vote for people who are pro-personhood, in other words, pro-giving full rights to embryos, but I will vote for somebody who has more moderate anti-abortion views, somebody who is particularly willing to have exceptions for the life and health of the mother, for rape and incest and those kinds of things. And obviously, I think abortion should be legal in way many more cases than that. But that's at least in the realm of possibility, is voting for somebody with those
views. Yeah. So you avoid the principal crazy sauce ones. And
So that's my basic view. Like Mitt Romney, for example, like although he supported some anti-abortion measures, that was not a big thing for him. He was the only Republican candidate last year who did not support personhood. And so like I was really happy about him on those grounds. I was unhappy with him on all kinds of other grounds. But I thought like his views on abortion were not a barrier to me voting for him. His views on the economics and other issues were definitely a barrier to me voting for him, but that was okay.
All right, then, moving on. Because it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
So I had a very good time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, now that we've done an actual real show for the first time in a couple of weeks, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Wonderful. Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just send it all to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
And I will forward it on to Greg. And folks, if you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, go visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
Great. I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.